Parnell, Senator Adams. The schedule for today, anticipated order will be SB 24, parental consent before minors abortion, and SB 41 will follow, assuming we have the time, environmental health safety audits. Teleconference sites online. We will limit testimony to 3 minutes per person. We have Anchorage LIO on. We anticipate having Delta, Kenai, Matsu, Sitka, and Petersburg. At least at this time, that's who I have on the list, and I haven't got the confirmation yet from
the cameras aren't here.
Telecommunication person, okay. But that's the intent. With that, we have the prime sponsor of SB 24 with us, and I would ask Senator Lehman to join us at the table. And since this bill has gone through some evolutionary process since introduction, Senator Lehman, will you bring us up to speed on this?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. Ordinarily, when I get to the Finance Committee, especially after being at going through two other committees with this bill, I would focus my comments almost totally on the fiscal impacts of the bill. But I understand there is interest by some committee members in dealing with issues outside of fiscal impacts, and so I believe it's important that I at least establish for the record in this committee some of the bases behind the bill and why I've introduced it. I don't believe this, with the exception of one member of your committee, that this is essentially the same bill that we debated last year in the Senate and had on the Senate floor. That bill was Senate Bill 105. Now, what this bill does, it doesn't deal directly with the issue of abortion on whether that is right or wrong. There are people who have strong feelings about that. This bill deals with the sub-issue of parental consent and parental involvement in a minor's decision regarding abortion. The reason for this bill, and actually what this bill does, is allow Alaska's existing statutes regarding abortion for minors to be enforced. Alaska currently has a statute that says any minor who is under 18, any girl who is pregnant and wants to have an abortion, has to get consent from a parent. Seems fairly clear in that law, but that law is not enforced, nor has it been for more than 20 years, on the basis of an Attorney General's opinion and subsequent conclusions from other Attorneys General that it is not enforceable in light of subsequent U.S. Supreme Court decisions on that issue. To make it enforceable, we actually have to step back, and in my opinion, what it does is weaken it somewhat and add what's called a judicial bypass, which is another option for a minor to seek consent or seek permission from a judge instead of a parent in certain circumstances. Mr. Chairman, for many reasons, I believe that enforcing our parental consent law would be good public policy. And I just want to tell the committee members that the concept of judicial bypass that is in here, this framework has already been tested at the U.S. Supreme Court level. We're not breaking new ground. It's been there. There may be some who will argue that it's unconstitutional. And let me assure you that this has already been tested by the United States Supreme Court and has been found to be constitutional. One other point before I get into the various points that support why I've introduced this bill is that our president, Mr. Clinton, and his wife, Mrs. Clinton, have both, and as so has the vice president on numerous occasions, said that they would like to see abortions, as they term it, safe, legal, and rare. And yet, so often, we see them and others focusing on the first two points and doing absolutely nothing to make abortions more rare. This, in my opinion, will help accomplish one of their goals, and one of my goals, and I believe a goal of this legislature, and yet I have yet to find anybody who wants abortions to be more plentiful. And by getting parents involved in decisions of their minors, I would hope that we would succeed in making abortions more rare. The first issue that I believe is important is protection of parental rights. And Senate Bill 24 will protect the rights of parents to raise their own children. Mr. Chairman, I'm the father of three young children, and I had the pleasure of reintroducing them to the body yesterday when they were in the gallery. I have to give permission, or my wife Carolyn has to give permission, for many things, including things almost as mundane as field trips. And during this past year, I accompanied our 12-year-old daughter when she had her ears pierced. I found it interesting that I had to sign a permission slip, and so did she, before the attendant would pierce her ears. And I said, well, what is this for? She said, well, you need to give permission for this procedure. And I certainly would consider abortion to be a much more significant medical procedure than piercing of ears. And likewise, if there's any medication given at school, we have to give permission for that. But in the area of abortion, for reasons that I find almost unfathomable, the law is different. And I note that we hired the Dittman Research Corporation to poll last year Alaskans on this issue, and found that 78% of the respondents said that they support parental consent for, as identified in this bill. 16% they would oppose it, and 6% were undecided. So among those who had an opinion, more than 80% of Alaskans said that they support a concept that is embodied in this legislation. So I believe that it's incumbent upon this legislature to respond to it. Strong public opinion. Even among those who consider themselves, as they term, pro-choice, there is support, and strong support, for parental involvement. The second major area is that of protection of the welfare of minors. The bill protects the health and welfare of minors who are often immature. And I'll note that in the first section of the bill, there's a legislative finding which states, the capacity to become pregnant and the capacity for mature judgment concerning the wisdom of an abortion are not necessarily related. It's my belief, Mr. Chairman, that teenagers will benefit from the support and counsel that parents can offer at a very difficult moment in that young person's life. Of course, I'm aware that there are some parents who are abusive. There are dysfunctional families, and that is probably how the concept of a judicial bypass evolved. But in our focus on dysfunctional families, we should not lose sight of the fact that most families offer a supportive environment for young people. Most parents love their children and want to help them through life's most difficult challenges, if only they are given a chance. And that's what this bill is about, giving parents the chance to be parents when they're needed most. A third area in which this bill responds is that of reducing teen pregnancies, births, and abortions. In other states that have enacted parental involvement statutes, the rates of teenage pregnancies, teenage births, and teenage abortions have declined in all three areas. Let me cite just a few examples. First is Minnesota. When Minnesota's parental notice law was in effect from 1981 to 1986, the pregnancy rate for teens age 17 and under declined more than 20%. In addition, the pregnancy rate for teens 18 and 19 declined by 25% during the same period. And in sharp contrast, the pregnancy rates before enactment of their law had been steadily increasing. The data I've cited come from the Minnesota Department of Health, and it was analyzed in a 1991 article in the American Journal of Public Health. The authors concluded, and I quote them, "These data suggest that parental notification facilitated pregnancy avoidance in 15 to 17-year-old Minnesota women. Abortion rates declined unexpectedly, while birth rates continued to decline in accordance with a long-term trend." And I end their quote. The positive effects of Minnesota's parental involvement law are analyzed in more detail in a document prepared by the American Association of Physicians and Surgeons. And when the United States Supreme Court reviewed Minnesota's parental consent law. This group of medical professionals submitted an amicus brief defending the state's law, and I believe that that brief is in your packets, and I encourage you to review it. The second state is Massachusetts, and study of their parental consent law shows the teen pregnancy rate declined nearly 17% during the first 20 months the statute was in effect. And this study was also published in the American Journal of Public Health, in this case in 1986. Then my third example is Nebraska, and to my knowledge, there's not been a comprehensive study by social scientists on the effects of Nebraska's parental involvement statute, which was approved in 1991, but there are data from this state, and statistics show that the number of abortions for minors decreased after enactment of the law, and at the same time, the number of births declined after its passage, whereas in the 4 years before passage, the number of live births had been on the increase, much like saw in the state of Minnesota. This suggests that the real effect of these laws is a reduction in the teen pregnancy rate, and that is a public policy goal I believe that we all endorse. Since this is the Finance Committee, I believe I'd be remiss if I didn't offer comment on the fiscal notes attached to the bill. And I'll note that the Office of Public Advocacy has projected costs of $168,000 annually, and my suggestion is that these are excessive costs, and let me quickly identify why. I believe they are based on flawed assumptions. The first one is that OPA cites that 61% of children already involve their parents in these decisions, and that means that 39% do not. They suggest that all of the 39% who now do not will automatically go the court route and seek a judicial bypass. I believe that this reasoning is counterintuitive. I'd suggest that it's just not right at all, and I would hope that a result of this law is that more children would seek counsel from their parents, and so substantially fewer of them would go the route of seeking judicial bypass. A second objection I have to their fiscal notes relates to their estimates for the costs. The experience of other states with judicial bypasses show that these proceedings are informal, expedited, and usually involve very little paperwork. And we have crafted that type of mechanism for this bill, and I believe their estimate of $1,500 per case is excessive. Regarding the proposed amendment that I believe Senator Phillips will be offering, and if he does not, I would applaud that decision. But I feel that I'd be remiss in not commenting on something that I believe has been before you and that you will be addressing. And that is to lower the upper age of in which this bill will apply from 18 to 16. Mr. Chairman and committee members, I'm opposed to this amendment, and I urge you to oppose it. And I believe it undermines the purposes of this bill, and it reduces substantially the population to which this bill will apply. Let me remind you that the existing law in Alaska requires consent for children under 18. So this bill has not changed that existing requirement. All it has done is stepped in and put in a judicial bypass. So we've purposefully not gone in and changed that. And of the 38 states which now have parental involvement laws, virtually all of them have the age of consent at age 18, not at 16. Voting to lower the age to 18 to 16 will result in Alaska having a weaker parental consent law than other states, and I have not heard one good reason offered why Alaska should have a weaker law than other states. The second is lowering the age to 16, as I've mentioned earlier, severely undermines the reach of this legislation. Most pregnancies among minors occur at the ages of 16 and 17, not at the ages of 13 through 15. If we look at data and analyze the data, for example, if you look at live births in Alaska, the Bureau of Vital Statistics reports 415 live births among teens aged 15 to 17. That's based on 1993 data. But if we look at teen births for minors under age 15, the number drops precipitously to only 19. Now, it was based on some data that we reviewed from 1991. So we see a substantial increase in teen pregnancies, or at least in births, among minors who are in their later teen years. Based on available statistics, I estimate that 345 minors each year obtain abortions in Alaska. And that's fairly consistent with what this administration has estimated. The numbers are a little bit different, but you know, there's no absolutely accurate source of information, so we have to estimate based on a number of different reports. But lowering the age of consent from 18 to 16 will remove the coverage of this bill from perhaps two-thirds to three-fourths of the minors who otherwise would be protected by this bill's reach. So, and third, lowering the consent age will largely minimize the positive effects the bill otherwise would have in reducing teen pregnancies, teen abortions, and teen childbirth. And if committee members believe that parental involvement encourages responsible teen behavior, why would you want to lower the consent age and deprive most pregnant teens of the benefit of parental counsel? And fourth, lowering the age of consent undermines one of the fundamental premises of the bill, which is the protection of parental rights. Parents have the right to be involved in the upbringing of teenage minors who are living in their home under their care. These are the teenagers this bill affects. And if the age of consent is lowered to 16, the state is essentially intervening in parental authority, splitting fine hairs and telling a parent, you have the right to be involved in the abortion decision of your 14 and 15-year-old, but not your 16-year-old. And I believe the state can't make a good case for making this distinction. Mr. Chairman, this issue boils down to a simple question. If you believe parental consent is good policy and will have positive effects, as I do, then you should keep the age at 18. Lowering to 16 only undermines whatever positive effects the bill would otherwise have. And that please don't vote for amendment which reduces up, you know, this, its impact up to 75% of the effectiveness of the bill, and then suggest that you support parental rights. In conclusion, Mr. Chairman, committee members, this bill is a common sense approach. It enjoys broad support among the public. And yet, I expect that we will hear, if you take a lot of public testimony, those who will criticize it. You will hear predictions of dire consequences if this legislation is passed. You may even hear from our director of the Division of Public Health, a medical doctor who I believe is off base when it comes to his testimony and his position on this bill. But as you consider the arguments, I will suggest that committee members keep in mind that most states have enforceable parental consent statutes. These statutes were viewed as sound public policy when first passed and still enjoy that support today. And I'll note that in most other states, when I've reviewed information, these parental involvement laws were passed with broad bipartisan support. This issue really is not one that knows partisan boundaries, and I would trust that that would be the same in Alaska. Senate Bill 24 deserves your support, and I commend it to you and request that you give it a favorable consideration. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. We have three people signed up in the chambers and two on teleconference. Senator Phillips.
Just to comment, because I'll be off in the age 16 amendment. But Lauren, you have an article here from the Empire in support of your bill. And in the article it says, a minor under age 16 cannot use firearms unless obtaining consent from a parent. They cannot get married without consent. They cannot get any major, oftentimes minor medical procedures without parental consent. If one argues abortion is just a medical procedure, then parental consent should be required here as well. It's right there in the article. Now, I'm not disagreeing with you on the what, but the when. I mean, it's right here in this article in support of the bill. Age 16.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Phillips, our juvenile laws are well established you know, on the age of 18. You know, we do, of course, make distinctions at 19 and 21 for some things, and at 16. And I was reminded of this this past year when my son got his learner's permit for driving at age 14. We do make some age distinctions. But the largest body of law with support for juveniles, the consistency at age 18, that is existing law, albeit not enforced. And I do recognize that there are some other distinctions when it comes to you know, the use of a firearm and some other things. And I'd encourage you to look beyond some of those numbers at the underlying theme of that Juneau Empire article, which is written by two people in that newspaper who both identified themselves to me as being pro-choice. But they said, on this issue, it's clear. You know, that's not the issue. The real issue is, should parents be involved in the decisions?
Well, the other thing, too, just a comment. This legislature and the last legislature is also trying to lower the age of responsibility for juveniles in crime. And I want to point that out, too. Same thing with runaway minors legislation. We passed that. So here in certain areas, we're lowering the age of responsibility for certain things that society makes a judgment on, and that's all I'm trying to do is lift them here. But I guess, well, that's the difference of opinion, I guess.
Senator Adams? A few questions, but you stated that in your testimony, the doctor that might testify on this piece of legislation was off base, but my comments to you, I think you're off base on this piece of legislation also. You had made the statement that ear piercing, you know, you need a parent from some. That is correct, but that's for liability of the business. It isn't as it is a requirement by state law, because in state law we have a certain listing of those. And in your testimony, you greatly said that you have three children. You don't need this law to have those three children. I have twice as many children as you. I've got six. So this law is not necessary. And if you want to get on the emotional end of that, you'll not do it here. One of the things that's wrong with this bill, and you stated that it's on U.S. Supreme Court, but as this bill is written, it, for the record, this bill is unconstitutional. And because it's privacy protection in our Constitution, you will state that the U.S. Supreme Court did rule in different states, but their Constitution does not mirror ours or is the same light as ours. And so that's one thing I would like to look at. Can you go through what the difference is between the original bill and judicial bill one time, please?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Adams, the difference in the bill, and perhaps my aide can identify while I'm talking this, the page and the line, and draw it to your attention, but we provided that the information from the court on the judicial bypass would be available from each magistrate, and we did that in response to Senator Hoffman's expressed concern last year, and perhaps your own, Senator Adams, on the availability of this information in Alaska, where these forms would be available from magistrates, so they'd be available at more places throughout the state. The court system in Alaska has said that they would conduct an expedited procedure and telephonic appearances, and so these, even though abortions are not conducted in rural Alaska, the access to the judicial bypass procedure would be available through the court system and through information from magistrates. So that was the information in it. On page 7, starting at line 22, the Judiciary Committee inserted the portion regarding the forms being available at magistrates.
Section 6 is a repealer. What does that one do?
We'll get the statutes available, and I'll be able to respond to that.
Okay, for that. What happens if you don't have a sufficient vote on this bill to pass the Alaska Rules of Civil Procedures? What happens to this piece of legislation if insufficient votes are for that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Adams, the rule changes in all cases provide for an expedited process. It provides for no charge to the minor. These are all procedures that the advocates of simplicity and expedition of these cases promote, and so I couldn't imagine why somebody would vote against the court rule changes, which in all cases would make it easier for that minor. But if somebody were to do that, the court would still have the ability to make those changes, and I would suggest that the court will make those changes, those rule changes itself.
For now, that's all the question I have, and I still maintain that this bill, as it's written, even from judicial, is unconstitutional at this point.
Mr. Chairman, I wouldn't want to let that one go unchallenged. Mr. Adams is suggesting it's unconstitutional, and I assume he bases that on our state constitution. He would suggest it be unconstitutional in the Alaska Supreme Court. Let me note that that very question has been litigated in other states. In Florida, which has a similar provision regarding privacy, that court has ruled that the privacy clause in their constitution would cause this type of statute to be unconstitutional. But in California, that court has ruled just the opposite. That case is still in litigation, has not reached final resolution. There are legal scholars who understand this section of law far better than I do, who argue very forcefully that the privacy clause does not reach down and cover minors to the extent that parents can't be involved in their lives. And we make clear distinctions on age and other things, and I believe that a reasonable reading of the law would conclude that there is a distinction between minors and adults, and that this law, as crafted the way it is now, would indeed be constitutional.
Senator Parnell?
I'll wait for the amendments. Thanks.
Senator Pierce?
Thank you. Senator Lehman, you heard me talk about one of my major concerns about the Bill and Judiciary Committee, which for this committee is embodied on page 5, lines 24 through 31, and the test that the court has to meet for the judicial bypass to work. And, Senator, I was the legislator who pushed for who asked first for Ledge Research to do a study back in the early 90s, which came back to us and was called Three a Day, Teen Pregnancy and Birth Rates in Alaska, which showed that 3 teenagers a day give birth in Alaska. 1 a month of those mothers is younger than 15. 1 in 5 of those is having her second, third, or fourth child. Approximately 1 in 10 Alaska females, 15 through 19, become pregnant every year. And more than 1,200 babies were born to Alaska teenage mothers in Alaska in 1991 and 92. Since 91 and 92, and since these statistics were put together by our own research people, we have we have updated that research on a semi-annual basis, and the numbers continue to grow. And 33% of the teenage births in Alaska in 1991 were to mothers under 18. So indeed, we have a lot of teenagers at risk, and we have a lot of families at risk throughout Alaska. The risk factors that lead to young women engaging in sex and then getting pregnant include a poor attachment in their family, inattentive parenting, and family management problems. Those are all problems brought on by the family, not by the child. Also, one of the major risk factors is a history of abuse, either physical or sexual abuse. Poverty is one of the risk factors. Doing poorly in school, which oftentimes is because of inattentive parenting or poor family management problems. So it goes back to the family and the environment that the child grew up in that leads the child to make poor decisions, to not have the high self-esteem that the teenagers need to be able to say no to having sex. Because if you say no to having sex, you're not going to have this problem. You're not going to get pregnant. You're not going to have to make a decision about whether or not you want to carry the child full term or whether or not you want to abort the child. So I think we need to talk about the root of the problem. We got a little bit there in the Judiciary Committee, but we didn't get very far in it. We're in a situation, Senator, where we are talking about not allowing or having parental consent before a minor can have an abortion. And I recognize and I respect your personal feelings about abortion. I also recognize that mine are different, and I would hope that you would respect mine. But I'm concerned about the young women and, in fact, the young fathers who are affected by whether it's this law or any other law we put into effect. We have villages in rural Alaska, and we have families in urban Alaska, where there is a tacit approval by the family members of young women getting pregnant, because that keeps them at home. Once they have a child, they're not able to get a job. And by the way, we're trying to cut daycare assistance. We're also trying to not pay for all the child care that's a part of welfare reform. How are these young mothers going to get jobs to support these children? What's going to happen to the baby that's born? That's what I would like to know. I think we need to take this and follow it through to the logical conclusion. Where's the safety net? The young mothers, many of these young mothers, not all, many of these young mothers are already welfare children. They were brought up on welfare. If they have a child, they and that child will be on welfare. It's a dependency cycle that never stops. Now, my real concern in this bill, as I said, is on page 5, subsection F, lines 24 through 31, which is one of the ways that a child would have access to a judicial bypass. And the only way the judge could allow it is if the court finds by clear and convincing evidence, which is a high test, according to the attorneys and the Department of Law, also attorneys who spoke in the Judiciary Committee, evidence that there's evidence of a pattern of physical, sexual, or emotional abuse of the complainant by one or both of the minor's parents, or by the guardian or custodian, or that the consent of the parents, guardian, or custodian is not in the best interest of the complainant. That means that if abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse is what caused the pregnancy, or if that abuse is what causes the child to feel that she is not able to go to her parents, then it had to be abuse by the parents. The brother, the uncle, the grandfather that got the young woman pregnant, who may be being protected by the family. For that matter, the outsider in the village who may be being protected by the family. The judge cannot give a judicial bypass in this case because it wasn't the parent who caused the abuse by clear and convincing evidence. It was an outsider. I find that unworkable and probably also very difficult for the young woman. I know we had the discussion in Judiciary, and Senator Parnell, after talking through it, thought that he felt comfortable with it. I thought, after talking through it, I felt even less comfortable with it. So once again, it's an opinion thing, and I respect everyone else's opinion. I don't think that we are, in this case, I would love to see every child in the state have a family situation where he and she want to share with their parents all the decisions they make. That's not what we have. And if we're going to have this bill, and I assume that the votes probably are there on the floor, at least on the Senate side this year, they weren't last year, but I think they are this year. If we're going to have a bill, I want one where a judicial bypass would be workable for a young woman whose abuse, physical or sexual, was caused by someone outside of just her parents. Because unfortunately, that's what we see. And while I said rural Alaska, it's not just in rural Alaska. It's in urban Alaska, too. The 1,300 or however many I just said, young women who are at risk, who are having children in Alaska each year, fit into these risk categories. They're the ones who have a poor attachment to their family. They're the ones who already have inattentive parenting, and why we think the parents are going to be better parents because we tell them the child got pregnant, I haven't figured out. They're the ones who already have family management problems. In fact, they're often the daughters of women who were teenage mothers themselves who are already on welfare. And they don't have good parental bonds. They also have had this history of abuse. I don't know but what, in doing this, we're not putting some teenagers at an even greater risk. And that's why I find that section of the bill very difficult in an overall issue that for me is very difficult, because I think what we should have before us, frankly, is a commitment to trying to help these young women get off the cycle of dependency, a commitment to the child care, a commitment to reforming the welfare, but helping them find the jobs, wherever those jobs might be, to help them get off welfare, to help them make decisions where they can afford to raise these children that we want them to keep. I, too, would like to see them be able to raise their children. I don't think we want to see them do it in a continued cycle of dependency that we know we end up with in many of the areas of our state, because most of these young women that we're talking about, indeed, are already the young women whose family life leads to a welfare dependency. They're not the sons and daughters of those of us making $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 a year. They're just not.
I'd like to move on to public testimony at this time, since I've been on teleconference for
approximately 45 minutes.
Can I ask you a question?
Can
you wait until we get public testimony?
It might help if
okay.
The question was out there, because I'd like
to... I just hate to keep people hanging on the line.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I was just curious if somebody out there has opinions about what that section means exactly, because I'm not exactly clear about what the functioning of the on line 27, the word or means, and maybe this was discussed in judiciary. Does it mean that the clear and convincing evidence standard applies both to the first section, lines 26 and 27, and the second section after the or does it just apply to the first section?
Good question. I would read it as it applies only to the first section, but who knows?
Mr. Chairman, I respect your wanting to go to the other testimony, but I will, just in response to Senator Pierce, allow that I agree that we as a people, as family, friends, churches, crisis pregnancy centers, and other support groups ought to be providing a better support network for girls who are facing the challenges of crisis pregnancies. But I'll also say that there is an or there on line 27, and if the court finds that consent of the parent or guardian is inappropriate, then it also could grant the bypass, and I believe that it covers the cases that Senator Pierce talked about. And I will note that this language is consistent with the language in the Ohio statute that has already been reviewed by the United States Supreme Court and found to be constitutional regarding the test. The court found that it was not an unreasonable standard to apply to minors. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I will stand back, and I would trust that perhaps when you've concluded your other testimony, I'd have a chance to come back and respond to other questions you may have. And I do have an answer to the question by Senator Adams regarding Section 6 of the bill. That's a repealer of the definition of abortion, and the bill has a definition in it that is a little bit more complete and consistent with the bill. So that it just has to do with replacing the existing definition with a new definition. And I believe that if you read the definition section, you'll find that it's medically more complete than the definition that was written in whenever this was, 1970 or something like that. We have a considerable history on the topic of abortion since that time.
At this time, I'd like to go to the teleconference. We have in Anchorage, Pauline Utter. Are you there, Pauline, or do you wish to testify?
Yes, thank you.
I don't know if you were online when we started the meeting, and I asked that people that testified that try to limit to 3 minutes if possible, and I'd appreciate that. Go ahead, please. Thank you. At Sitka, we have Virginia Phillips. Virginia, are you still there?
Yes, I'm still here, and thank you very much for allowing me to testify. I'm Virginia Phillips, and I'm representing the National Right to Life. I am the National Right to Life spokeswoman for American Indians and Alaska Natives. I am one fourth Kikin Indian. I support SB 24. I want to talk about sense, facts, fiscal responsibility, moral compassion for minor women. Facts, the state pays for minor abortions without sense. The Journal of American Medicine, July 1, 1993, and the New England Journal of Medicine, January 1994, reports on the deadly after effect of abortion, breast cancer in women who abort their first pregnancy. True, the breast cancer does not show up until a woman is in her 40s. There are more than 30,000 studies supporting this sad fact, and only the self-admitted blood speech studies quoted by the pro-abortion advocates. 7. Many parents give their consent. Most male relatives responsible for pregnancy want to get rid of the evidence of the pregnancy by abortion. 6. It is nonsense for the paid to stay for these abortions. A. They are expensive. B. The state is sentencing these minors to a sentence of death. 2. Being pregnant only shows that a minor is not capable of making common sense decisions. 3. Actions have consequences for the minor as well as the state. 4. Let the parents be responsible for their children now and for their future. Fiscal responsibility. 1. The state has a responsibility to protect minors from their own lack of judgment and knowledge that actions have consequences. 2. The state has the obligation not only to spend money wisely now, but look to the future of Alaska women suffering from breast cancer and blaming the state, and out of that way, suing the state. Please vote for SB24. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we'll go to another person in Sitka, Pete Halgren. Pete, are you there?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Pete Halgren. I'm the chairman of the Republican Party of Alaska. The Republican Party of Alaska supports SB 24 and urges its passage as a necessary means to constitutionally effectuate the state policy first enacted in 1970. Parental consent or judicial bypass review prior to performing an abortion on an unemancipated child is a compassionate and necessary protective tool for Alaska's emotionally immature children. Families and adult character are built not on pre-pop issues, but to facing life's challenges. Government support of escape hatches, which ultimately destroy families, inhibit character formation, and induce dependence, is an example of the false compassion that has brought America to the point where it has the highest teen pregnancy rate in any industrialized country. Building families and true compassion for pregnant children strongly argues against continuing the failed policy of providing secret abortions for our children. I recognize that we can have legitimate differences of opinion on this matter, but I would note that SB 24 is in complete accordance with the grassroots written and adopted platform of the Republican Party of Alaska, and also with the national platform of the Republican Party, and is in accordance with the desires of the strong majority of Alaskans and Americans throughout the country.
Thank you, Mr. Allergan. We'll go now to Mrs. Zachary in Petersburg.
Thank you very much for letting me testify. I just want to say it does my heart feel to hear what Senator Pierce said about working on the root of the problem, and I am all for that, and I feel that this bill is part of working on the root of the problem. My husband and I have already sent in testimony and given oral testimony before the Senate and the House Committee. Last Friday, I listened to the House Judiciary Committee proposed debate. There were two basic frames of thought. The one we do not agree with says that this bill is an issue of women from having their constitutional rights. In this case, it is the right to make the decision to kill their unborn baby. But we are not dealing with women in this bill. We are dealing with girl children, with minors under the law. We are dealing with unemancipated children who still need nurturing and guidance and support. For most everything else under the law, parents are legally held responsible for their children's actions and the restitution of those actions, if need be. Why not, in this extreme serious case, also? The frame of thought we do agree with is this. A parent's right to protect, counsel, guide, and support their minor children, that's the issue. Look around our nation. A vast majority of families no longer know how to work through and stand by each other in the crises of life because our government has taken those rights and responsibilities of growing and nurturing together as a family unit out of the home, handed them over to agencies. These agencies are not allowed to nurture and instruct our children in moral ways of living that when one can run to an agency to give you a quick fix to the consequences of your own irresponsibility or the irresponsibility of someone else perpetrated upon you, you don't need to learn to take responsibility. This has ultimately weakened our nation and caused a huge tax burden in order to sustain these agencies. It has also caused wedges of communication and growth to be driven into our family structure. In the days when people had to answer to their families and work with their families, there was far less immoral living, and therefore there was less out-of-wedlock pregnancy and less abortion, which is actually the ruthless devastation of life. Please pass this bill and allow those of us parents who want to be a part of the healing of our deteriorating nation to stand together and to do our job. And also, do not change the age from 18 to 16. Minors need those 2 years to grow in maturity and responsible and good judgment. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next, we'll go to Fairbanks. Ruth Ewig. Ruth, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Please state your name, affiliation, if any, and proceed.
My name is Ruth Ewig. I am part of the Interior Right to Life. Up here in the valley, I would like to thank Bert Sharp, our Interior Senator, and the rest of you, having the courage to defend family and parent rights. And I support Senate Bill 24. Parental rights need to be reestablished. We as parents are responsible for our minors. If our minors cause damage, we as parents are responsible to pay the cost. If something happens to a minor, we are by law the ones to be contacted. If our minors are hurt, we pay the medical. If they die under anesthesia, whether from an abortion or under surgery, we as parents are notified afterwards. Imagine the parent's condition if they are approached after their minor dies under anesthesia and they are not even informed that the surgery was taking place to begin with. The devastation cannot be described with words. It is not up to the legislature to guess whether parents will react responsibly. That is a different problem that should not be tied to this bill. This bill goes back and reasserts parental rights. In the past, or up to now, we have been undermined without having known that what's going on with our minors. And that's the way it stands now. With this bill, we would know what's going on, and then we would be able to respond. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll go to persons that signed up in the finance room. First, I have Rupe Andrews. Did you sign up? Yes, you signed up. Good morning.
Good morning.
Senator Phillips, just a minute.
Just for timing purposes, are you going to allow for questions at the end of the testimony
yeah.
for a particular
We'll go back to questions okay. by committee members. Go ahead, Rupe.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Rupe Andrews, and I'm representing the Alaska League of Women Voters here today. The Alaska League of Women Voters is opposed to Senate Bill 24. I'm going to confine my remarks very narrowly to the judicial bypass section. You've heard enough testimony. I don't want to emotionalize this any further. But we do have a concern that the judicial bypass is a real stretch of the imagination in assuming that teenage girls, particularly the younger ones, are going to be able to successfully access the legal system in the state. In looking on page 4 of the committee substitute from line 9 down, this is section 18.16.030, judicial bypass. There is language in here that is not only ambiguous, but just plain far out on the next planet. We're just not sure how a young girl already traumatized by being pregnant is going to be able to, one, know how to deal with the process of accessing the system and then be able to do it successfully within any kind of a time frame, given the geographical size of our state and the uneven distribution of the population in the state. It does present serious geographical and legal problems here in our opinion. Some of the language we feel is very ambiguous. Page 4, line 23 through 25, after the complaint is sufficiently mature and well enough informed, what does that mean? We don't really have an understanding of that. And I don't think anyone else does either, as a matter of fact. Very briefly, we think this is bad social and public policy because it adds additional trauma to the teenager. It will not reduce teenage pregnancies. The states that you heard mentioned before, Massachusetts and Minnesota, where pregnancy rates have declined, They just went someplace else. They have a well-developed road system down there, and they went to other states. And there's the problem there is that there's no empirical data to show what pregnancies, how many were terminated, particularly when you cross state lines. We feel that it won't improve parental communication. Dysfunctional families are dysfunctional for a lot of different reasons, and this in no way is going to help the situation in a dysfunctional family situation. And that summarizes my remarks this morning, Mr. Chairman. If there's any questions, I'll try to answer them.
Not at this time, Rupe. Thanks for the testimony. I do appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you.
Next, I have Dr. Nakamura.
3 minutes.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. I am Dr. Peter Nakamura. I'm the director of the Division of Public Health, the person alluded to a number of times this morning. I might, if I can digress a minute and mention that on the second floor today, we have a lot of EMS people from around the state who are here holding or celebrating the special EMS week. And down there, they have these nice little patches that you can put on your hand to see how tense you are or how relaxed you are.
Yes, we take that.
I'm doing pretty well. I would encourage you to take the opportunity to go down and meet with some of these people who are from your own districts. In reference to the bill, I guess a common tenets of society and good sense says that parents should be involved with their care, the health care of their kids. It says that the involvement is generally productive and useful to the kids. But what we're talking about there is parents who are concerned, parents who are involved, and parents who are supportive. Senator Lehman mentioned that 61% of these children who are minors and pregnant already do access parental consent. That leaves about 39% who don't. But of those 39%, or of the 100%, there's another 20% who do access a responsible adult, a member of the clergy, a member, a teacher, another member of the family, someone else who's responsible and will guide this child along the course and help this child make the right choice. Unfortunately, of the 40% who don't seek, or 39% or so who don't seek parental guidance, one-third of these children are already in abusive families, families where there's anything from child abuse, domestic abuse, situations in which already the setting is there to create the possibility of increased violence and coercion if the child is forced to return into this environment. And there are significant numbers of these. If you look across the nation, we have about 5 million or so women who are victims of domestic violence. And in these families, or at least 2.5 to 3 million, depending on the figures you accept, children who are also abused in these families. And these are the kids that we're asking by this law to re-enter into this abusive situation. Don't think that's a very healthy recommendation. The bypass is not going to be effective, especially in a state like Alaska, where access to the judicial system is extremely difficult. There was a CS in the House on a similar companion bill that says you can even maybe call up the judicial system and get a bypass through the telephone. Pretty difficult to imagine that happening in this state. First off, access to a private phone is not the easiest thing in the world. Secondly, I can't imagine a judicial system that would accept information on the telephone. I'm thinking of a young boy who perhaps is involved and is a parent or the responsible person for this pregnancy, being on the other end of the telephone saying, "I'm this child's brother. We'd like to get a judicial bypass." Very difficult to control such a thing. If I could respond to the questions that I've heard or statements that I've heard today.
Sure. Mr. Moore. Senator Phelps.
Well, you're limited to 3 minutes here now.
Okay.
So there's other people that I want to ask questions of.
All right. I was hoping to address the questions.
Will you be able to?
He'll be here. He lives here.
Oh.
Happy to come be available.
Okay. Yeah, we do have a couple more to testify, and then we'll come back to questions and answers then, if that's okay.
Happy to do that.
Go ahead.
You want me to...
Go ahead.
You want me to continue?
Yes.
Okay, sure. Okay, there was a question raised about the requirement that a child get parental permission for a simple procedure like ear piercing. The consequence of bypassing that consent procedure is much more significant in the case of an abortion than an ear piercing. An ear piercing, you can go out and pierce your own ears or have another friend pierce your ears. But in the case of an abortion, yes, you can induce your own abortion or have someone else do it who's not trained to do this, but the consequences are significantly much greater. To force a child to do that is not good medical practice. There is a question of the experience in other states in terms of pregnancies, abortions. In the three states that were studied the most, a good 39 to 45% of the abortions from those three states were conducted in adjacent states. So the abortion rates did go down in those three states, but they went up consequently in the other states. I've heard various figures about the numbers of deliveries to these young teenagers. The Council for Ethics and Judicial Rights for the American Medical Association has a quotation that 38.4% of those, there was an increase of 38.4% in teen deliveries in Minnesota as a consequence of this act. I'm not quite sure who this American Association of Physicians and Surgeons is that's referred to quite frequently in terms of producing the data supportive of such a bill, but there are greater than 40 medically related associations, including the American Academy of OBGYN Pediatrics and the more well-known associations, who have signed a statement in objection to this type of a required parental consent bill. There is a statement that abortions are expensive. Abortions are expensive, but they're much, much, much less expensive than carrying an unwanted pregnancy to term and the costs related to that delivery and to the care of that child. There was a statement made about breast cancer and increasing after such a procedure. In January of this year, in the American Journal of New England Journal of Medicine, there was an article, a study of 1.5 million women in Denmark where there's a requirement for reporting of these kinds of procedures that demonstrated that there is no increase in breast cancer. Also, the editorial comments have demonstrated why some of the previous studies are wrong. So I think we can say without any equivocation that there is no increase in breast cancer following abortion procedures. I think that's enough. There are just any number of issues here. One last one is the safety of the abortion procedure. The abortion procedures under any situation are safer than carrying a pregnancy to term, even a normal pregnancy. So with that, feel that the bill is not appropriate, not a good one. It will force children into abusive situations in which they really are not going to get the kind of help they need.
Thank you.
We'll ask questions. Are you going to stay in the room?
Sure.
We have one more person in the room to testify. And we'll maybe if individuals want to come back to questions, we will.
Sure. I'll be back. Thank you.
Next, I have Dave Rogers. Signed up. Morning, Dave.
Morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Mr. Chairman, my name is David Rogers. I represent the Alaska Women's Lobby, and with your permission, I'd like to read their prepared written statement into the record. It'll take less than 3 minutes.
Go ahead.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. The Alaska Women's Lobby agrees with the sponsors and supporters of this bill. Minors should talk to their parents before any decisions are made about a teenage pregnancy. We are told that most do, but like it or not, some won't, often because they come from homes where physical violence or emotional abuse are prevalent, or because their pregnancy is the result of child sexual abuse by a family member or stranger or date rape. And don't be surprised if many of these same kids won't talk to a judge either, even if that judge is right down the street. The courtroom is intimidating enough for most adults. It can be overwhelming for teens. And Mr. Chairman, how can you guarantee confidentiality? Mr. Chairman, under this law, these adolescents caught between two equally unacceptable alternatives may be at risk and in danger, either due to delays in seeking appropriate medical advice or because they take things into their own hands and run away or risk their lives by having illegal or self-induced abortions. This has happened in other states, and it will happen in Alaska. That is quite a price to pay to send a message that most minors don't need to hear. And according to the AMA, there is no convincing evidence that these kinds of laws will actually get kids to talk to their parents who wouldn't otherwise. Nor are we convinced that these laws will reduce abortion or birth rates. In fact, we have statistics that suggest the opposite. So for us, the potential and unintended harm that may result from this legislation clearly outweighs the potential but unlikely good of encouraging parental communication and lowering birth and abortion rates. This is best handled by developing a comprehensive prevention program which prevents the pregnancy in the first place. Finally, Mr. Chairman, we believe this legislation also violates a teen's constitutional right to choose. Please keep in mind that under Alaska law, minors don't always need parental consent for major decisions. It's particularly ironic that under this bill, a pregnant teen must get permission to have an abortion, but will continue to be considered mature enough to make independent medical decisions for her newborn child. For all of these reasons, Mr. Chairman, the thousands of Alaskans represented by the Alaskan Women's Lobby oppose SB 24. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, at this time, Senator Phillips, do you have a question?
I have two questions. One to Pete Hollergren.
Yeah, Pete's still online. Are you still online, Pete?
Sure, Senator.
Okay, and the other person in Anchorage, Utter?
Yeah, Utter.
Are you online?
Pauline.
Pauline Utter, are you online?
Yes.
Okay. Pauline, I have a question here. I don't disagree with Senator Lehman's the what, it's the when. And so I guess what I want to ask you a question is when does a girl become a woman, at what age? Because I know you feel this is more of a dealing with abortion versus parental consent, but I wanted to get from you at least your view of the world of the age of when a girl becomes a woman.
As a mother of two daughters and a grandmother of one, I feel that a child who is under the age, for a child to become pregnant, a female child, is truly a disaster. I mean, I'm not sure you can necessarily place a specific age on when a child, when a young female becomes a woman, because the maturity rate both boys and girls bear again. You know, at some point I don't know if you can say perfectly well at 16 and you're capable of making your own decisions, or at 18 you're capable of making your own decisions, but I'm sure adults, supposed adults who are 25 or 26 who probably aren't capable of making their own decisions. So sure, it's an arbitrary number.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm not sure that I think you could spend weeks working out what you think is the right number, but I'm not sure that you come up with a satisfactory answer either. So it's sort of like maybe this should be.
Okay, thank you. And Pete, you mentioned something about the Republican platform, but I do believe it did not have an age limit on that. It just said minors, right?
That's correct, Senator. And I guess my answer would be, as far as I'm concerned, a girl becomes a woman at the same age a boy becomes a man. I don't see anything sexual in that. Our society in Alaska is generally deemed children becoming adults at age 18.
Biological. Okay, thank you very much.
Clarify that. Other questions? Did the doctor stay? Yes. Could you come back to the table? I had a question if you know what the percentage of women under the age of 18 that has abortions in Alaska, say for the last, statistically, how many of them live in a rural setting and how many live in an urban setting? I'm just trying to pin down.
I don't know if we could ever get that answer for you. The problem being abortions are not reportable in this, are not mandated to be reported in the state. About the only place where you can get any specific data in this state is through the Medicaid experience. And I would have to get that answer for you.
Didn't you or someone say there's around 1,200?
I said that.
So somewhere there must be some statistics.
Well, Senator, actually, the doctor is right. There aren't statistics. Let me go back to those numbers, and I'll cite where they came from.
May I comment? There are a lot of projections that we have to make, some based on national experiences, some based, and then transferring that national experience to the state. We can, knowing the numbers of abortions done through the Medicaid program and a number of clients who are eligible for this program, then we would have to make some projections based on that. So we wouldn't ever have any absolute numbers.
Okay. Well, I was just concerned with one of the statements that several times has been made that in the rural areas, lack of access to the court system, modern communications, the privacy of telephone communications. I'm just wondering how many of them, percentage-wise, occur in, under those circumstances. And, you know, if it's 5%, 10%, 50%, that would then become more meaningful. Senator Pierce?
Thank you. Just to clarify that, the teen pregnancy rates and the birth rates that I spoke to were calculated using census information from our own Department of Labor and from the Alaska Bureau of Vital Statistics. We can go back and collect the data on the teens who became pregnant and actually gave birth to a child. And we can tell where those children were in the state. We can get statistics as to what areas of the state they were from. What we don't have available are actual abortion statistics because those are not reportable.
And that's what we're addressing right now, though.
Correct.
Which could interfere with the current process if this legislation is perceived as interfering with the current process. Senator Parnell.
Related to that issue, I don't think it would. In the Judiciary Committee, we heard that there are that the rural girls who get pregnant go into communities that provide abortions, and that there are no communities, there are no abortion, that to get an abortion you have to go to a community, and those communities have to have courthouses. So in other words, there are no doctors performing abortions in communities that do not have access to court system, unless Dr. Nakamura has new information since the Judiciary Committee on that.
No, these abortions are not conducted in the rural areas. The problem is that the judiciary system is very intimidating. I can't imagine many kids who would access this thing on a voluntary basis. It's a very difficult procedure for kids to commit themselves to this kind of an exposure.
Senator Parnell.
And on that issue, it is a very intimidating process. It's very intimidating to have to go to a doctor. And my understanding is that when a girl flies in from rural Alaska, she's usually met by either a social worker or a caseworker from an agency, a nonprofit agency, to help walk her through that process. And if they're going to walk her into the doctor's office, they're going to walk her into court just as well. So it's intimidating either way, but if they have people by their side now in the doctor's office, which often they do, they're going to have people by their side at the courthouse too. I don't see the concern there.
Two intimidations are always worse than one.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator, oh, I thought you were going to move something.
Well, yeah, I'm just waiting for you to say something.
Senator Pierce.
Members from the welfare bill last year, did we end up with the grandparental responsibility section in the welfare bill?
Yep.
And how does that work?
They go back to live with their parents. They have to pay.
A child has to go back to live with the parents
right. Before
she can receive?
From the boy's, boy father's parents.
Again.
To collect child support from the boy's parents. The girl who was pregnant had to go back and live with her parents under the welfare bill.
In order to get welfare, she had to go back.
Child support.
Well, that's child support. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think it had to do with getting welfare.
I thought it was in the welfare bill, so it must have been connected
well,
somehow.
Separate bills. We had child support and one on the.
Senator Phelps, did you...
Well, I'd like to...
I see a proposed amendment in here. Did you wish to offer it now, or...
Yeah, I'd like to move the amendment. The amendment basically... I move amendment number one, Mr. Chairman.
Amendment number one has been moved.
I'll object to that.
There has been objection. Senator Phelps.
Mr. Chairman, the amendment reduces the age of... I don't want to say consent, but it just reduces the age from 18 to 16 and to require parental supervision for abortions.
Any other discussion on the amendment? The amendment has been moved and there has been objection. Please call a roll on amendment number one.
Yes.
Senator Cornell?
No.
Senator Adams?
No.
Senator Donnelly?
Yes.
Senator Phillips?
Yes.
Senator Pierce?
Yes.
Senator Sharp?
No.
Four
yeas and three nays. With that, amendment number one has passed. Senator Donnelly.
Mr. Chairman, I'm still examining this section. It appears on page 5.
Page 5.
And this, of course, is connected to page 4, lines 26 through 29. I guess anytime you have a series of ors in a statute, I think you raise a question, and there may be some drafting standards that say here's how you interpret it, but my experience, courts are all over the place on how they interpret those kind of things. Is the drafter here or anybody who's been involved in that drafting process? Because frankly, it's not clear to me whether the clear and convincing standard of evidence applies to both of those clauses or to just the first one. And I'm concerned, I'd like to hear some testimony about the appropriateness of the clear and convincing standard.
I'm staff.
Question basically, Senator Donnelly, is whether clear and convincing evidence applies to the following ors. Is that the question, Senator Donnelly?
Yeah.
Okay. State your name, please.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, my name is Mike Pauley, staff to sponsor Senator Lehman. And we have not posed that question to the drafter. It would be my opinion that the clear and convincing standard would apply to both on either side of the or. But I think it is something that we should request a drafter's opinion whether the courts would interpret it that way. With respect to the clear and convincing evidence, this legislation was modeled after parental consent statute passed in Ohio, which was tested by the U.S. Supreme Court and held to be constitutional. And that clear and convincing evidence standard is part of their law. We're not aware that it has caused any difficulties for the process in the state of Ohio.
Go ahead.
I guess my question doesn't deal with the constitutionality issue. It deals with how a court would interpret the evidentiary standard on these two sections on either side of the or. Do you know how the court interpreted it in Ohio? Whether it interpreted as the clear and convincing applying to both sides of the
Senator, through the chair, I do not know the answer to that, but we can make some quick calls to our some contacts in Ohio and find the answer to that.
Even if the court ruled one way or the other in Ohio, doesn't mean the court in Alaska would rule one way or the other, and we could, one way or the other, make it clear in this, with a drafting change, what we actually want to do. I'm not convinced the clear and convincing standard is the best standard, but if we want it to apply to both sides, I think we ought to be real specific, considering that there's no question that this particular statute's going to be litigated out and appear in court, and that would certainly be a question for me as a judge.
I'm going to move that as amendment.
I think we need a drafting opinion before we get to that particular point.
Senator Parnell.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think all Senator Donnelly is saying is let's make it clear one way or the other if we're going to have the standard. And so, I mean, at page 5, line 27, I would move that after the third or, insert the words by clear and convincing evidence. Senator Donnelly. Is that the correct or that you're looking at?
Yeah, that's one way to go. And if that's before us now, then I'd like to discuss why we feel a clear and convincing standard is the appropriate standard of evidence in these cases. I mean, I imagine there was a discussion in judiciary about that.
Well, actually, I asked what clear and convincing standard meant, and the person from the Department of Law who was there at the time could not give a description of the standard beside the other standards of beyond a reasonable doubt and whatever else.
Preponderance of the evidence.
Beyond a preponderance of the evidence. So we never really got to what does clear and convincing mean. So I still don't know.
It has been moved by amendment number 2 by Senator Parnell to add after the third or on line 27. The court finds by clear and convincing evidence that the, just insert that phrase right after or.
After the third or?
Yes, after the third or on line 27.
And once we do that, I think then all that's doing is clarifying what's here, and then we can have the discussion on whether it's preponderance or clear and convincing, but I think you got to make it consistent to start with anyway.
I guess,
Senator
Chairman, I suppose that if it was defeated, then a court could, well, of course, then the problem with these things is what happens in committee isn't very persuasive to a court. Courts seem to look to floor action and actual discussion and votes on the floor. I was going to suggest that if we voted down this particular motion, a court could interpret that as meaning that we didn't want the clear and convincing standard to apply to this. But I also know that the courts seem to do whatever they want to do. They seem to look at legislative records and just find whatever supports what their goal is. I've seen it in a lot of cases, it seemed to be. I've seen it where they adopt a standard for reviewing legislative records in one case and then completely not follow it, the same court, in a subsequent case. So it's hard to predict, but I think that we ought to just be clear whatever we want to do here, one way or the other. And
any other discussion on amendment number 2?
Mr. Chairman, I think I'm going to probably vote against it because I'm not convinced yet that the clear and convincing standard is the appropriate standard. And
let me state the intention of the chair is to hold this bill till tomorrow. We have another senator that wants to get on the committee that wants to get an amendment drafted. Possibly could revisit that then.
It's not that I'm disagreeing with Senator Parnell about creating this and making clarity here. That's my whole point, but I just don't know for sure if that's the standard that I think is appropriate.
Well, let's just save a clear and convincing discussion then.
And can we have someone here who can go through the different standards and explain to them? Because I've always wondered how a judge can get to clear and convincing evidence and yet keep the confidentiality if he can't talk to the supposed abusive.
That's why the burden is so easy, because the minor girl could stand in court and swear that she comes from an abusive home and that her parents were the cause of the abuse. And if there's no other adverse witness, the only evidence that's there is her testimony. That's clear and convincing. That's it. So he has to believe her. I mean, and that's what a judge does as a finder of fact. They have to weigh the credibility of the witness or witnesses, and if she's the only one there, clear and convincing is an easy standard to get to.
So it's the only.
It's the only evidence in evidence.
So where are we on amendment number two? Is it on the table yet? Is that the...
Okay. At this point, I'll withdraw the amendment, and as long as we can take it up tomorrow, first thing.
Okay, and I would ask that if there is, we'll try to get the drafter here too, to also give us a little insight onto what the drafter thinks clear and convincing is, and whether it ties to the cascading other ores and conditions. I'm sorry that we didn't have information saying that there was two other people online since 9 o'clock to testify. I'm sorry about that. I just got the information. If they're still there, I'd like to go back to that testimony. And with that, I have in Anchorage, Bob Lynn. Are you still there, Bob? Yeah, I sure can. Would you go ahead? I'm sorry about the snafu here. I either got it covered up with paperwork or didn't get it in time.
Well, thank you very much. I'll broadcast the public debate. Good morning. My name is Bob Lynn. 4,400 Kevlar Drive in Anchorage. I am the president of Alaska Rocks Life. More importantly, I am the father of six children, of those four are young ladies. SB24.
Thank you. I also have on the belated list Theda Pittman. Are you still there?
I am. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Where the evils have been in effect, that the court proceeded. All that I read from those tells me that this is not a law that accomplishes the effect that you desire, and I urge you to reject it.
Thank you. At this time, I don't have anyone else listed on teleconference, but is there anyone else on teleconference that wishes to testify?
We have two in Delta Junction.
We have one in Mattsu.
You got two in Delta Junction and one in Mattsu?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Let's go to, let's take one in Delta at this time. Please state your name and who you're affiliated with and proceed.